answer on creation. And I did get some pushback. I made a claim in there that you could take chapter 1 of Genesis poetically or allegorically, and some people aren't really okay with that. And the reason why, of course, is because a lot of people deny the Bible, they deny its literal truth because of scientific discoveries or whatever, and so they come out basically denying that the Bible is trustworthy, especially in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and they tend to allegorize or spiritualize everything that's said in there. And so you'd say, well, you know, we don't want to become that. We don't want to start setting the Bible aside in favor of scientific discoveries or whatever, because science is quite often wrong, and scientists are quite often making claims too big for their the evidence that they have. And so we got to be careful on that. And so Bible believers have seen the errors of scientists who deny the scriptures. And so they've gone back very strongly to a fundamentalist, literalist interpretation of everything. And anyway, I just wanted to try to clarify that. I do believe that the first chapter of Genesis can and in some ways must be taken poetically. I don't think it's trying to give you a scientific description of what happened. I believe it's trying to tell you the truth of what happened, but not in any kind of scientific detail. And I'm going to prove that to you at first, and then I'm going to point out to you why I take it the way I take it. So, first of all, let me point out to you that Christians are not against science. We are not against science. In fact, science, as we know it, modern science, was invented by Christians. Real Bible-believing Christians invented science. All the founders of the major branches of science, all of the founders were Christians. I can't think of one. No Muslims, no atheists, no, all of them were Christians. They believed in the God of the Bible, basically like you and me. Now, they might have been a different denomination or whatever, but all of them were Christians. Bacon was a Christian, and Newton was a Christian, I was trying to think of the guy, the painter. What's the guy's name? Somebody say it. All of those. They were all Christians. I don't know why my mind just went blank on that. Anyway, they were all Christians. So we're not against science. I mean, I'm not against science. I don't believe that we should see it as a battle between science and religion. I had a guy just the other day tell me, he says, all religion is, and he used a bad word, and I said, you know, you're right, religion is that. And I agree. I just really do believe religion. I do not want to be religious, people. I don't want to just sit there and do forms over and over and rituals and believing things that make no sense. No, I want my mind to be open and my eyes to be open, and I want to be able to see. And I don't believe God lied to us in the world that we have around us. I don't think he created fossils in the rock to fool people. I believe that this is evidence that we can study and come to some conclusions about. But I don't believe that we have a real clear understanding of everything that happened just because we read the Bible and it says it a certain way. Now, there are some things that the Bible says and they're pretty clear, but let's just point out a couple of things about the first chapter of Genesis. And if you've got any questions, just raise your hand and I will try to address whatever question you might have. I just want to point out a couple of things about Genesis. We want to talk about allegory. You're not sure that it's an allegory. You think, no, I think it's talking about specific literal, for example, days. It says the first day, the second day, the third day, evening and the morning. It has to be talking about 24-hour periods. But I just want to ask you, what does a day mean if there's no sun? There's no sun. There's no sunrise. There's no sunset. There's no midnight. There's no noon. There's nothing that we consider. The concept of the word day has to do with a earthbound person. Somebody on earth looks at a day and says, I know what a day is. We all understand a day. And then it says God created the world in 6 days. And I believe that that's true. But stop and think about it. The word day before the sun is, there's something different there. It's talking about something different. So when somebody balks at that and says it had to be longer than 24 hours or it had to be some other kind of a day, I don't believe we can say dogmatically that they're wrong. Now, I know that's almost making me out to be a heretic here in this church. So, just bear with me. It's going to be okay. I'm going to show you. It's going to be all right. All right. The day without the sun, no sun at all, didn't exist until the fourth day. That means the word day is, I'm not sure what that means. And if they say, well, it just means 24 hours. Well, that implies that there's a clock. And I'm just not sure that we can define it by a certain amount of time. In fact, they say time is relative. Depends on how fast you're driving or how, you know, I don't know. And I'm just not sure. I just don't think we ought to be, I ought to close our minds completely to any option or any other possibility or consider anybody else who has a different opinion a heretic or an unbeliever. Maybe not. Maybe they're not unbelievers. Maybe they've got some knowledge that we don't have. And that's entirely possible. All right, I want you to, I want to read to you verse 11 of chapter, Genesis chapter 1. We could read the whole chapter, but I don't want to lose the time. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 11, hopefully you have read this chapter. This is one of the, Genesis is one of the most interesting books ever written, and everybody ought to read it and really understand it. Verse 11, and God said, let the earth bring forth grass. I want you to stop and consider that. Let the earth bring forth grass. Turn to chapter 2 and verse, what is it? Verse 5. Verse 4. These are the generations of the heavens and of the earth when they were created in the day. It says one day that they created the earth and the heavens. And every plant of the field before it was in the earth. There's two different ways of describing how plants were created. One, he says, let the earth bring forth. Now, I gotta tell you, that sure does sound like he just said, let it just happen. Let's just let the earth spontaneously bring forth, as if it's just built into the nature of dirt to bring forth plants. Now, does anybody believe that? Do you believe that plants could just be a spontaneous production of dirt? I don't think so. In fact, what we know about plants is that they are very intricate, deeply sophisticated DNA things that cause it to grow. Biological systems are not simple, and they can't just spontaneously come out of the earth. And he says very clearly that he created the plants before they were in the earth. But that's two different statements he's making. He says, let the earth bring forth grass. And then he says, he created the plants before they were in the earth. Surely you can see that those are two different ways of describing the same creative event. They're not extremely detailed in telling you how God did that. But I know that evolutionists that believe the Bible, they say, well, I believe evolution, I believe the Bible. They're saying that God created the system of evolution, and that's what's proven by Genesis chapter 1, verse 11. God said, let the earth bring forth, which kind of sounds evolutionary. It kind of sounds a little bit like that. In fact, you'll read there's more of them. It says the same thing. Look at verse 20. And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life. Waters bring forth as if it's just going to happen in the water. And yet we know that God fashioned these things with his hand, it says, and other things. Then verse 24 says, let the earth bring forth every moving creature or living creature after its kind, cattle and stuff. Now we know that the earth, the dirt, does not bring forth cattle. We know that. But, and it does sound like God is saying, I just set this up so it would just happen. So he just creates in his intelligence, he creates a system where this stuff is just going to happen over the centuries, over the millions of years. This is the idea that some people have that creation was an evolutionary process. Now that doesn't mean these people aren't Christians. I don't know where their faith stands. It just doesn't mean that they're not Christians. It just means that they're trying to make the Bible fit what they can see in nature. And you do that also. I do not believe in evolution. I don't believe in theistic evolution. I don't believe God set up the process of evolution to create anything. I don't believe that. But it's not because of what the Bible says. I don't think the Bible actually contradicts that. I'll tell you what I do. I look at the theory of evolution itself, and I think the theory of evolution is bonkers.
Right,
it's absurd. It cannot happen. It did not happen. It's not possible. And anybody who says, oh yes, we've got proof of it, they're smoking their socks. They do not know anything. They have no proof of anything. I did sort of informal debate on a YouTube channel. They had made fun of some Answers in Genesis video, and they were just really arrogant atheistic types and making fun of the creationists. And so I just, on the comments, I just asked a simple question. I said, why don't you just answer this question that they had? They had a question. Give us an example of evolution. And so they had, in the video, they had just given the example of the change in the pigmentation of rats. So there are some rats that are one color, and these rats have a mutation. Some places have a mutation. They've turned into another color, and that was their example of evolution. Folks, that is not what we're talking about. We're not talking about the change of color. That's lateral change. I'm talking about increasing change in complexity. Evolution is telling you that there used to be rocks and sand and water, physical stuff, and somehow that turned into people and chimpanzees and fish and things, and you've got to explain how that happens. That's got to be an increase in sophistication, an increase in organization, an increase in genetic information. And there's not one example anywhere of an increase in genetic information come about just by accident. No, that doesn't happen. You can lose genetic information, but you can't gain it. That's why evolution has no possibility of, and there's not one example. Nobody's ever given us an example of something becoming more complex in its DNA complexity. No more sophisticated. Never happens. They haven't seen it yet. And in fact, just doing your own calculations will prove it's not true. It did not happen. And I know some of you young folks are a little bit intimidated by the college professors who have studied things for a long time, and they tell you that it's proven, it's a fact. They'll say evolution is a fact. I would like you to get a little bit of confidence yourself and recognize, especially if you could just study it out a little bit, recognize that evolution is not only not a fact, it has been disproven over and over and over again by what we see. The fossil record disproves it. The microbiological markers disprove it. And the fact that nobody can come up even with one example of it, even a minor example of an increase in sophistication, basically proves it. They really do have a philosophical belief in, I would call it a mythology. It's the mythology of something from nothing. It's the mythology of stuff happening automatically, stuff getting better without any input. And this is simply not true. It is a false religion. Stuff doesn't just happen. We can call that creation 101. Stuff doesn't just happen. I had a debate with an atheist one time, and he talked about science being falsifiable. So that if you have a scientific position, it ought to be falsifiable. You ought to give me a way of proving it false. And so he said, give me a way of proving God false. And I'm just not sure how you could prove God false, but I would just mention to you, and I would just ask you, show me how something can come from nothing. And that would be as close as you could get to proving the concept of God false. Can something come from nothing? And frankly, I just don't see how that's possible. I don't see how possible something to come from nothing. And so if you can't show that, then how can you disprove God? There are some other things about falsifiable, like the origin of DNA. Just show me how a cell can happen without a designer. It's just, I just don't see how that's possible. Or even Or even just go out into the universe, look at the different planets, and find that Earth-like planet is very common. Just find out that, if you can find out that Earth-like planets are very common, sort of like the Star Wars scenario where you get in your ship and you go over there and there's one with all kinds of life. You know what they have found is that this is extremely uncommon. They can't find anything like it anywhere. Not in our solar system and not outside of our solar system. And they're still looking. So we'll give them a few more centuries. They might come up with something. All right, I don't believe that Genesis chapter 1 disproves theistic evolution. I just don't believe that that's the best explanation. There are three explanations for Genesis 1 and creationism itself. The first one is theistic evolution, meaning that everything we see about evolution is true. It's just God guided it. And so it could be billions of years and God is guiding it. Every time there's an increase in genetic information, God did that. That's the creative force, and they say these days are talking about millions of years. They're epochs, they're time capsules, they're little segments of time that God used to create all these different things. And I've actually read fairly good books on this, trying to prove that the Bible's order is correct and the guesswork order of the evolutionists is incorrect. And they've gone to their trouble to do it. And I think these are genuine Christians trying to put together the chapter one of the Bible to make it fit what they can see in nature. I just believe that they are incorrect. For one, it says that he made the sun on the fourth day, and I don't know how that can fit. You have the plants on the third day and the sun not till the fourth day. I don't see how that can fit. Anyway, the second way, and this is the way I was taught when I was a child, from the time I was small, and I read many anti-evolutionary books before I ever heard of the third way. I read many anti-evolutionary books written by what we call the gap theorists, people who believe in the gap theory. And there's still many, many Christians that believe in the gap theory, including Peter Ruckman, and most of the old timers will still believe in the gap theory. And the idea of that is Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." And chapter 2 says, "And the earth was without form and void." And then they will go over there to Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18, and it says, "God created not the earth in vain." And then they will say that word "vain" is the same word as the word "void." And so the earth was without form and void. God did not create it void. So something happened between chapter 1, verse 2, 1 and chapter 1, verse 2. And that's called a big gap. And that gap, they think, Satan fell, created, Satan did all this, had a huge kingdom on earth, and God finally destroyed it by water. And they will take 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 3 or 4, something like that, where it says that the earth that then was perished, being destroyed by water. And they don't think that's the flood. They think that's the satanic deluge when God destroyed all the dinosaurs and everything. Now, that was a very elaborate explanation. It's not really found in the Bible. You don't see it there in the Bible. It doesn't. There's a lot of things that don't seem to make sense. One of the biggest problems is changing words like vain and void, because in the context, it's not saying the same thing. It didn't say that God did not create the world void. That's not what it says. Obviously, when you create, it's going to start off void, it seems to me. Then you have to add to it and make it better. But that's what God did. Anyway, they'll also use Genesis chapter 1 in verse, I think it's 27, where he says, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." And that English word, replenish, they say, well, that means to fill it up again, which means before Genesis 1, it was already full. And so they have to replenish it, proves that it was destroyed. Something very fancy was destroyed before the creation account in Genesis. The problem is that that word "replenish" doesn't necessarily mean fill it up again. It also means fill it up completely. And we still use the word in that term. Like you could say a book is replete with errors. Means it's completely full of errors. It's got errors in every page. It's all full of errors. It's not saying they've done it again. They've got errors in it a second time. That's not what it's saying. All the proofs of the gap theory to me don't make the point. They don't They don't prove it. All it really does is it gives the opportunity for you to look at the fossils and say, this is billions of years old or millions of years old, and not deny the Bible. You still can believe the Bible. Big problem with that is where the sun is created on the fourth day. And they have to say, well, no, the sun was created before that. It just appeared on the fourth day, which doesn't make any sense to me. That's not what it says, and that does not follow. Now, there's a newer way of thinking about the gap theory. And that is, they think that Genesis chapter 1, all of Genesis chapter 1 and the first part of chapter 2 is talking about the original creation that happened millions and millions and millions of years ago. But then in Genesis chapter 2, starting at verse 3 or 4, where it starts talking about the second time of creation, it talks about the man and the woman being created. They think that is the gap. There was a gap between the first creation and the second creation. I haven't gone into that much. It doesn't terribly interest me. If you want to study that out, that's fine. I hold to a young earth. This is the third way of understanding it, the young earth creationism, which means that the earth is not nearly billions of years old. It's much less. Now, I do have a problem, though, with the young earth creationists' dismissal of scientific evidence. For example, we know the speed of light. We know that light takes 8 minutes to get from the sun to the earth. It takes a long time. It's not immediate. Light is not instantaneous. You can't shine a light here and you get to someplace else instantly. That's not how it works. But it's very fast. But still, they have seen, they've got these big telescopes, they can look out into space and they see huge space. I mean, this is huge. And they've got ways of figuring out how far these things are away. And the fact is, most of these galaxies and stars are so far away that if the Earth was only 6,000 years old, the light wouldn't be here yet. If that's when it was created, the light wouldn't be here yet. And the explanation is that God created the light in transit, that when he created the stars, he also created the light that was shooting from the stars so that it would look like they're that far away and they're that old. But at that, I don't like that explanation because it seems like it's saying God is lying. That God is telling you, look at this star. It looks like it's a long way away, but it's not. Trying to get you to believe the Bible instead of your own eyes. Basically. And that, who knows, that might be true, might not be true. I personally don't like that explanation. I'm reserving my decision. I just don't know. I don't know how that works. I don't know why the universe looks billions of years old and the Earth itself doesn't look that old. And then, of course, you've got the radiometric dating, which they have ways of finding out how old rocks are. The only problem with radiometric dating is that if rocks have been submerged underwater, then the dates are not reliable. It makes them out to be very much older than they are if they've been in water, because certain rare elements are diluted, they're taken away and leached out, they call it. They're leached out. And other elements that are much more common are deposited by water. And so it makes the age of the rocks much older than they are if it's been underwater. And of course, according to the Bible, the whole world was underwater. And this is called sedimentary rock anyway. A whole lot of this rock is sedimentary, so it implies that it was underwater. And underwater for quite a while. I don't trust any of that. I don't dogmatically say any of it's true. I'm interested in their theories, and that's fine. But I just want to point out the reason why you can take Genesis chapter 1 as poetical or as allegorical. First of all, because there are allegorical components in it. It very clearly states, like the earth bring forth, that's an allegorical statement. He's not saying that's how it happened, because he clearly says it happened a different way. And there's other things in there. But the Bible throughout it uses poetical or allegorical statements to describe creation. Throughout the Bible. How often does he say he stretched out the heavens with his hands? With his hands. Well, I don't know, but that sure seems like an allegory to me. It seems like it's a poetical way of saying how God has the power to stretch out the heavens with his hands. He says he measures them with the span of his hands. In other words, that's how big God is. But this is poetical allegory. It's a way for you to explain, to say how God, how big God is, how great God is, because the heavens are huge. Another thing is, in the Bible, many times it talks about the earth being very, very old. Way older than humans. It says the earth abideth forever. Generations come and go, but the earth abideth forever. Talks about that many times. There's a lot of allegorical thinking going on when it's explaining creation. I could read you a bunch of them, but let's just read a couple. Look at Psalm 136:6. Psalm 136:6. Now I know you're probably now even more convinced that I'm a heretic, which is fine. I am not going to be dogmatic about any of this. I don't think they've completely got all the answers yet. I don't think Christian creationists have got the answers yet. Psalm 136, 6, to him that stretched out the earth above the waters. God stretched the earth out above the waters. That's a allegorical way of saying God separated the earth, the land from the sea. And it says that in Genesis chapter 1, but he stretched out the earth over the waters. The Bible talks about the columns, or the pillars of heaven. This is an allegorical way of saying that space is held up out there by God's power, not saying that there are actual columns out there that are holding it up on the four corners. People do make fun of the Bible because of this allegorical or poetical speech that it has quite often. Let's look at, let's look at Psalms 104 verse 5, and we'll compare that to another place, Psalm 104, I said verse 5, it says, who laid the foundations of the earth that it should not be removed forever. He made the earth to last a long time. So it's talking about the earth, this planet being here a long time. Talks about many times about it's abiding forever and it's abiding. He made it very firm and stable. So it lasts a long time, longer than humanity. Anyway, but now look at Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 3. You might be able to quote that one. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 3 says, through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God. Now, how many times does it say God spoke, God said, God commanded, and that's what happened? But over there in Psalms, it says, he laid the foundations of the earth. In verse 6, it says, thou coverest it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. That was talking about the flood. Look how many times it talks about creation in a poetical way. So, I would not consider somebody who does not believe in young earth, or who does not believe in the gap theory, that somebody who believes in day age evolution or whatever, that doesn't automatically mean that they are heretics or that they don't believe the Bible. You have to understand that the Bible is speaking to us from our viewpoint. And in my mind, Genesis chapter 1 is possible to understand allegorically. Now, I know some of you are just saying, no, that can't be. Do you have an objection to that I might not be able to answer? I'd be glad to listen to you. Anybody? Go ahead. You got a problem? Go ahead.
I have a question about the waters above the firmament.
Okay. Above the firmament. Okay. That's a different subject, but we'll have to deal with that. The Bible does say there's waters in outer space. I personally believe that the flood, in fact, I'll get to that because I'm going to go to the flood now. I tell you that chapter 1 of Genesis can be understood allegorically. I believe there is that possibility because it's used that way allegorically throughout the Bible. The way it talks about God creating, it uses poetical speech all the time. So yes, chapter 1. My problem is that chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, all the way through the flood and the Tower of Babel, cannot be taken allegorically and still believe them. Either they're lying or they're mistaken, but if you take them allegorically, you're just throwing them out. You're just saying that doesn't mean anything. Was there a person named Abraham? Was there a person named Noah? Was there a person named Enoch? Was there a person named Adam? Those chapters in the Bible, all the way up through the flood, don't leave any room for poetical imagination. That's not the way it's spoken. The way it's written is as if it's pure history. Like they're saying, this is what happened. This is how old he was when his son was born. This is how old he was when the flood came. This is how old he lived after the flood. And it's referred to many, many times as actual history. And when it says, and people who don't believe in young earth creationism have a tendency to treat all of that as if it's just one big poem. They'll take from Abraham on, they'll say, okay, that's history, but before Abraham, that's just an allegory, that's just a myth. But I don't see the Bible that way. I can't interpret it that way. In my mind, the rest of the Bible sort of forces you to take the chapter one of Genesis literally.
Amen.
It forces you to take it as if it's speaking to you in plain language, even if it uses poetical statements once in a while or occasionally. It still is trying to say there was a 7 or 6 day period in which God created. Whatever those days mean, that's what it was. Those were the 6 days that God created, and not millions of years, and not evolution. None of that makes any sense at all. For example, the flood says every high hill under the whole heaven was submerged. That's what the Bible says. Every high hill under the whole heaven. I don't know how you can say that was just a local flood. And the size of the ark proves that they didn't need, they weren't looking to try to save themselves from a local flood. That's not possible. If you take the Bible and you trust it, then you'll see that it's talking about a global flood. Let me tell you another reason why I believe in the global flood. And that's because we have mountains, sometimes tens of thousands of feet high, full of dead carcasses.
Yes.
Dead animals, dead plants. I'm talking, there are places, there's the Karoo Formation in Africa that has, it's like the size of the country of Mexico, this Karoo Formation, and it's like 10,000 feet deep or even deeper, and it's full of animals, full of fossils. Or you go out here to the petrified forest and you just look at it and read their little explanations that they have on every part. You go into these little museum things in every little station and you read what they're trying to explain, that this was a meandering river and these trees fell down. And then just go out and look at them and you can say this did not happen by a meandering river. This was a flood that completely wiped out an entire forest and buried it in sediment. This is clear. The flood is observable to this day. Look at the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon was not formed by the Colorado River. The Colorado River followed the path of least resistance and went down it. I get that. But it wasn't formed by that. And there's many, many proofs of that. For example, you've got side canyons that are almost as big, but no river. There's no river on that. This was obviously a dam-breaking event. In other words, there was something was dammed up. It could have been ice or whatever, had a huge amount of water dammed up somewhere. And when it broke, it just eroded all that stuff in one fell swoop. And that's been proven many, many times. In fact, you can go up here to Canyon Lake and go on the bottom of the lake below the dam and just look up at the breaking dam, the dam breaking, valley or gully that was washed out when Canyon Lake overflowed. And you can see exactly what we're talking about. The Grand Canyon is clearly a huge flood event. And this is demonstrable. There are many, many other proofs of it, and there are other people that can give you a much better explanation of it than I can, especially in this short of a time that I have to speak on it. What was I going to say? It's not possible to just treat You can't just treat the Bible like it's straightforward, scientific text. You have to read the Bible and understand what they're saying and why they're saying it and what the purpose of it is. Is it possible that the 6 days of creation were explained or that God did it that way in order to teach us something else? For example, in the Ten Commandments, it says, 6 days shalt thou work, and the seventh day you gotta rest. Why? Because God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. Is it possible that he did it in that way in order to teach us something? I think that's a much more understandable way of understanding why God does it this way. It doesn't have to be some kind of a poetry. He could have actually done it that way in order to teach us more than just the straight text is saying. Many, many times the Bible does that. Take the Bible as it is, yes, but don't restrict it to one certain way of thinking. I think you ought to treat the Bible scientifically. Now, I was asked about waters above the heavens. The Bible does say there was waters above the heavens. In Psalm, I believe it's 104, says there's water, there's the heaven of heavens, there's water above the heavens, plural, meaning beyond where the birds fly and beyond where the moon is swinging around, those two heavens, there's got to be water above that. That's what it says. And it says that the windows of heaven were open and the water came down to earth. I don't know, but it seems to me like it's saying that we got water coming from outer space to cause the flood. And they have a hard time figuring out where the water is. Also says the great deep was broken up so that there's water below the ground. And you think, well, how does it stay down there? How come it doesn't come up? And they've got their explanations. They've actually found water below the ground. About 250 miles straight down, there is a huge reservoir of water contained in a certain kind of rock. And this water, the rocks somehow come up to the surface every so often through volcanism, and they can find evidence of this rock. They say there's more water there than there are in all our oceans combined, and they've proven that all that is true. There's water under the ground, and there's water in outer space. We know that because comets are made largely of ice. There's water out there. So, yeah, I'm not really sure. I don't really think that's a controversy that there's water in outer space. But, I believe you can take that literally. There's water up above the heavens. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure. Anybody else have a question about this? I've actually run out of time.
Back to the time period, Bill. Just a reflection on, in the argument of making it literal. Say the problem is there was no sun and moon at that time to make the time, but the story was not written till after it happened, and it's a reflection of the time period that they have. So they're going back. It says evening and morning of the first day. So from Moses' perspective, he's inserting the time period there. And then the verse you gave in the Ten Commandments where it says God created everything in 6 days, and he's giving that as a lesson. He's not telling us that we work for how many ever years, metaphorical years. He's talking about little days there, right, in Exodus.
Well, that's the argument. In my mind, that doesn't, to me, I don't know, it might prove it to y'all, but it doesn't prove it to me. In my mind, the day, like for example, in chapter 2 of Genesis, it says God created it in one day. He created the heavens and the earth in one day. And that's, it just depends on what do you think he's trying to say? I don't know. In my mind, that doesn't prove it. What does prove it to me is how literal everything after chapter 1 is. Now, yeah, I realize.
Yeah, you define day as evening and morning for the first day.
Yeah, but what's an evening without a sun?
Well, again, I was saying that from Moses' perspective, when he's writing about that time, he's defining. Kind of like I would say, I'm just thinking in my head some examples. My wife went to school at Southwest. Well, she wasn't my wife at that time.
Okay, I understand that. But at the same time, we're talking about a day that he mentions that had no sun. Whether it's from his viewpoint or not, the first day had no sun. The sun didn't come till the fourth day. So first day, second day, third day had evening and morning. That was the first day. What, second day, third day, whatever. But there was no sun. So if you say it's a 24-hour period, if you say it's... I don't know what a day is without a sun. It doesn't make sense to me. But to me, that's not the proof. The trying to get nitpicky with the language, because I've heard all the debates about what yom in Hebrew means. And I mean, who cares? You're trying to understand what he says. There's a difficulty with chapter 1 of Genesis. It's not written to be a scientific treatise. It's trying to tell you God created this, and he did it in these days for a purpose, because it teaches you something more than the scientific attitude. In fact, I will tell you something. All the physical creation stuff in the Bible is treated as much less important than the big things like forgiveness of sins and righteousness and all this other stuff. And when we sing in our hymn books, you'll find a whole lot of hymns that talk about the wonders of God as a creator. And those are all wonderful. But if you have that hymn and it never talks about the true wonder of a God that loves humans, or even the fact that humankind exists and that we have minds and we understand right from wrong and we're made in God's image, which are much bigger stories of creation than the physical creation. There are three levels of creation. There's the physical, which has to do with atoms and stars and space and time. That's physics. And they've got all kinds. This is a fantastic creation. This is huge. It's fantastic. The second level of creation is biological. You have DNA that creates cells, and these cells turn into multicellular organisms, and it is so complex and sophisticated that it puts the physics science or creation almost as if it's not even important compared. Biological creation is huge, but you have a third level of creation, and that's his God is the Father of spirits. He creates mind. He creates knowledge of good and evil. He creates spirits that will live forever. This is huge. This is big. This is much bigger even than biological, physical life. It's much, much bigger than that. And he talks about eternal life. And he talks about right from wrong and forgiveness of sins and huge things like he's going to show the glory of the church throughout all ages. The church itself is a huge creation that God is doing. He's building something with us. All of these things are much more important than the physical creation, and we can get ourselves bogged down on the physical part of it and not even realize how much more important the other part is. I think it's important, especially for young people that are going to go to college and all that. They need to know to have serious doubts about what these people think they know. They don't know nearly as much as they think they know. They do not understand gravity. They do not understand light. They do not understand physics. Can you believe the impossibility of this mythological Big Bang that supposedly everything was compressed in a little singularity and it exploded? Why would it explode? How did it get there? From nothing. And if it exploded, fine. Let it explode like all explosions. But no, they say it got faster and it deflated and whatever. And now it's even still going faster. What's causing all that? They don't know. And I tell you what, they're wrong. I don't know exactly where, but they are. And they'll find out sooner or later. They will be, it won't be easy. It'll be like a revolution in their mind. It'll be forced to prove that they were wrong. And they've done a lot of studies on scientists and how they refuse to admit when they're wrong. They have to die off. Scientists have to die off for a younger generation to go with the new theory, because scientists are stubborn. So I would say, all of you, keep reservations about how smart these people think they are. They are not that smart. Now, don't think of them as stupid either, because they're not stupid. They're probably just as smart as you.
Yeah.
But don't let them bully you into thinking that they've got the answers, because they really don't. And even if they had some answers about the physical creation, they're missing out on the rest of it. They don't know about forgiveness of sins and God creating the church and what God is really going to do with his creation throughout history, throughout the future and eternal life and all that. Those things are much bigger. Do not be bullied or bullwinkled into thinking that these people are the cat's meow. They really are not. Have a healthy dose of skepticism about what any college professor tells you. All right, we've run out of time. I'd like to take more questions, but we've run out of time.